This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, our hearts go out to the folks impacted by the devastating tornadoes in Oklahoma.
Dozens have been killed, hundreds injured, thousands of homes, businesses, a hospital destroyed, schools. Just unbelievable devastation there, Mark.
And the officials are worried there will be a growing number of walking wounded in that community as reality sets in that many of these residents have really lost everything.
It seems there's been so many tragedies in these recent months, and as always, you can't help but be moved by the spirit of resilience and the way communities come together to help each other, and just reminds us how determined the human spirit is in the face of these ordeals. Really amazing to watch.
You know, I know on the front end of these tragedies, the medical triage system works very well. But on the back end, we've been talking a lot about the behavioral health responses that are needed for the long term in these communities. And there's been a real focus amongst all of these tragedies of redirecting ourselves about the importance of behavioral health services in our community. And our thoughts and prayers are obviously with the folks in Oklahoma.
You know, it's never all about one sector. It's not all about prevention, not all about tertiary care, not all about mental health. It's about all of it coming together. And I'd like to take a moment to note a milestone of a different sort and to say that Marilyn Tavener has been confirmed just recently as the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, the first time since 2004 that an individual has survived the political vetting process to be formally approved. And I think that's worth noting, and congratulations to Ms. Tavener.
She has a big job at the head of CMS, which serves the healthcare needs of some 100 million plus Americans.
And that's a bright spot in the somewhat contentious intersection between politics and healthcare policy these days.
That is for sure. And beyond politics, it's good to keep our eyes on folks who are fostering innovation in healthcare. Our guest today is a co-founder and CEO of the Institute for Health Technology Transformation, an organization that seeks to foster accelerated adoption of health information technology to improve healthcare delivery.
Waco Hoover will be talking about his organization's recent report on how big data analytics in healthcare will be a game changer for helping health systems to improve outcomes, reduce errors, do a better job of tracking patient health and improving patient safety. And of course, all of that should also lead to reduced cost in healthcare.
FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson will be checking in with another corrected misstatement about health policy in the public arena.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio. And as always, if you've got comments, please email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview in just a moment. But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Electronic health records and disasters. They seem to be able to ride out the storms together. As officials tally up the damage and death toll from the Oklahoma tornadoes, one vulnerable area remained intact. After the disastrous hurricane and floods when the Hurricane Katrina hit in New Orleans in 2005, the event was compounded exponentially by the loss of thousands of medical records for residents in the floods. Electronic health records have come a long way since then. In spite of epic damage in the wake of the recent tornadoes in Moore, Oklahoma, the electronic health records for some 2 million people in the region remain safely tucked away electronically in a remote data storage facility in Kansas City. Many of the essential elements of patient records for more than 2 million people have been backed up by the Regional Health Information Organization serving Oklahoma City and stored at Cerner Corporation Data Warehouse. Evacuating patients from the hospitals that were damaged in Moore was a problem, but wrangling its patients' records won't be. ADHD and obesity. The two are linked, apparently. Study shows those young people with attention deficit disorder were twice as likely to become obese as adults, a link apparently to the lack of impulse control. I'm Marianne O'Hare.
We're speaking today with Waco Hoover, co-founder and CEO of the Institute for Health Technology Transformation, one of the nation's leading organizations, bringing public and private sector leaders together to foster the growth and effective use of technology across the healthcare industry. Prior to founding the organization, Mr. Hoover served in the United States Marine Corps, earned his MBA from the University of Florida, and received his certification at the Harvard School of Public Health's Program for Leadership Strategies for Information Technology in Healthcare. Mr. Hoover, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Waco, your institute just released a report, Analytics, the Nervous System of IT-Enabled Healthcare. In it, you explore the explosive growth and potential of health information technology, as well as the need for a more systemic approach to the collection and analysis of the massive amounts of healthcare data. Can you help our listeners understand the different types of healthcare data you've been exploring and why this data analytics is so essential to improving the healthcare landscape?
So there are a number of different types of data when you think about the healthcare industry. You've got claims data, clinical data, and then you also have how that data is stored, whether it's structured data or unstructured data. With respect to the claims data, we're talking about from payers, insurance companies. And then when we're talking about the clinical data, that's collected on the provider side. And historically, a lot of that data has not been married up. However, as the healthcare system continues to evolve and there is increasingly a lot of need to reduce costs, but at the same time, improve outcomes and improve quality, organizations are able to glean a tremendous amount of insight by combining these different types of data. As we move into an era where most data is stored on an electronic health record as opposed to on paper, we're going to be able to, again, glean tremendous insight on best practices. And then another aspect of it is when we start talking about managing populations. And I think, you know, last but not least, in terms of how that data is being used properly with healthcare reform, accountable care organizations, they're going to succeed. It's going to be imperative for organizations to have access to actionable data, and data analytics is a tool, a strategy, a mechanism that organizations can effectively do that with.
Well, Waco, maybe you could talk a little bit about this new model of health data mining where business and clinical intelligence overlap, and if you have some examples from your work that might be really helpful for our listeners as well.
One example, looking at fraud data from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, by using predictive analytic technology, they were able to save $115 million on fees that were otherwise, you know, fraudulent in nature. And that's pretty tremendous. Just one key example right there when you start to look at how we can analyze this data. So when we start talking about how we are moving from volume, i.e., you know, you get paid per transaction, now we're in a place where we actually have the tools where we can actually do analysis. When we're talking about the business intelligence, we're looking at things like operational information, cost. So there's going to be a tremendous amount of opportunity for how we're able to extract this data information. But as we start to, you know, merge these two disciplines, we're going to see a tremendous amount of opportunity there.
Waco, health data analytics is a pretty new discipline, fueled by the rapid spread of electronic health records, and that's really been kick-started by the federal government's commitment through the meaningful use dollars in 2010 to incent providers and institutions to adopt electronic health records. And I think a lot of there's a lot of uptake on that, both by institutions and providers. And yet the healthcare industry is a little different than the banking industry, which has a fairly sophisticated adoption of banking information. But we lag behind on this in the healthcare world. Can you give us a sense of the readiness of the majority of healthcare institutions and maybe the sort of solo providers to dive into these analytic areas? I think you talked a little earlier about some of the obstacles that are inherent in getting this, which is, you know, whether the data is structured or it's unstructured data and some of the other ones. But give us the 50,000-foot look at how the institutions are doing and how the private providers are doing.
So with respect to analytics, you know, we're very much in our infancy. Now, there are organizations such as University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, Kaiser Permanente, Mayo Clinic, which we've all probably heard of, they have some very robust and advanced strategies, but they're definitely in the minority at this point. Electronic health records, that's really just the starting point. Once you get patient information into electronic format, that's when the really fascinating, amazing things can start happening, where we can actually start to look at population-based care. We can then how that impacts the individual patient. You know, so after several years of the Meaningful Use Program, the most recent data is the Office of the National Coordinator, and the most recent report that they put out is that about 44% of U.S. acute care hospitals had a basic electronic health record system. So in order to do anything meaningful really with data analytics, you need to have that patient data in a digital format. Well, we've made some tremendous strides. We still have a long way to go where organizations are really going to be in a position to leverage analytics in a really meaningful way. Some of the hurdles, the siloed nature of data in healthcare, We talked about claims data, you know, business intelligence, you know, different organizations. And so it's really, really challenging to get that data in a way that you can match it up and analyze it in a very sophisticated way. The other piece of it, I think, is that, you know, when you start thinking about analytics and data, it's really understanding where to start. And that's something that a lot of organizations are struggling with. You know, they're first getting their electronic health record system in place. So again, understanding where to start, not boiling the ocean, if you will, is a really key challenge for organizations as they consider when to get going and how they can tackle analytics.
Well, Waco, it's a very interesting kind of futurist perspective. And as you were answering Mark's question, I was thinking about three people that we've had on the show in the recent or not so recent past: Dr. Joe Selby from the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute, Dr. Carolyn Clancy from AHRQ, and Todd Parks, formerly of I think the Office of the National Coordinator, and his famous "Let's Liberate the Data" approach to things. And all of them have in common a deep desire to take this data and make it meaningful to patients. And it seems to me that if you put your futurist glasses on, it really fundamentally begins to change how we do research and who can do research and how we allow for research to be done. And I wonder if you've given some thought to the research implications of this sort of broad scale.
So absolutely. And quite frankly, I think that's one of the most fascinating areas when you start talking about electronic health records. We all, I think, very much think of those in a very transactional way. Your, you know, lab data is stored there, an encounter with your clinician. But, you know, from my perspective, where it really gets fascinating is when you start looking at things like genomics, and you start looking at analyzing, you know, millions of individuals with a chronic condition across the country, and then you can also start to benchmark various characteristics or variables within their care. And then you can start looking at what genetic markers they have. And then you can also get into things like pharmacogenomics and how sophisticated we can get with that. Approximately 30% of cancer drugs, approximately 30% of patients don't respond to certain types of cancer drugs. Now, that's pretty profound when you can think about the kind of cost for that. Mm-hmm. And also, if we understand that from the get-go, how much more effective that care can be, or how much better that the end of life could be for somebody, depending on, you know, their situation scenario. So on the research side of it, I think it's absolutely an amazing, and as you said, you know, the futurist perspective on it, I think it's going to really transform where we've come over the past two decades, and it's going to accelerate even quicker over the coming 10, 15, and 20 years. It's going to be quite fascinating.
We're speaking today with Waco Hoover, founder and CEO of the Institute for Health Technology Transformation, committed to bringing public and private sector leaders together to foster the growth and effective use of technology across healthcare industries. You know, I want to pull the thread a little on Margaret's question there, and been thinking about consumer engagement strategies around healthcare information, because you have the sort of the traditional information about my health condition, but really, don't you also want to sort of marry it up with information about my patterns of behavior? I mean, where is that merger of the purely health information with what the consumer's thinking about in terms of their lifestyles approach? Because if you're going to manage some of these chronic diseases, it's not just by the numbers, right? It's going to be sort of how we motivate people. And I'm wondering, sort of thinking about this big data that we were hearing about, you're doing it just on the healthcare side, but is there a marriage coming up between the two?
I think first and foremost, you know, we're starting to talk about not just being a patient, but actually being a consumer of healthcare. And traditionally, we're rather passive in the nature in terms of how we, you know, approach our healthcare and how we engage our clinicians. You know, it's very much something that, you know, they're in the business of sickness. So we go and see our clinicians if we're sick. So a part of that transformation is, you know, consumers being more engaged. There's a number of amazing studies that actually talk about more activated patients, specifically with chronic conditions, how the cost is significantly lower. Think about the airline industry, for example. It would be really, really challenging, and we'd all be very, very frustrated if we had to call someone or go in and see a travel agent to book airlines. So healthcare can borrow so many of these things, and there's groups like Kaiser Permanente, Epic. There's a number of different tools that are out there right now, organizations doing this, where you can simply go on, look at the availability for your clinician or specialist, and make an appointment. I think that that's the earliest stages of that, that convenience factor, if you will, that will slowly get us more activated in our care. And then the other piece of it, you're talking about, you know, being monitored outside of, you know, the hospital or your doctor's office. After all, that's where we spend most of our lives. So I think tools, for example, something as simple as Fitbit, which you're probably familiar with. It's a wristband that you wear around, and it tracks sleep patterns, how many steps you take, so many of the things. And then there's an app that feeds into your smartphone or other device or computer. So I think those types of things are when we're just starting to see how that's going to impact us. And I don't necessarily think at this point in time clinicians are ready to, you know, completely embrace that, because one of the biggest things that they're concerned with is you know, is the information trusted? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what research is out there that demonstrates that if I compare the information from your Fitbit with, you know, the information that I'm looking at, you know, whether it's lab results, cholesterol, blood pressure, et cetera, that there's actually going to be a significant amount of change or behavior change as it relates to that. So, you know, as it relates to this area, it's fascinating because it holds so much potential, and you've seen, you know, there's over 30,000 health apps on the market now. So as we kind of go into this, there's going to be a tremendous amount of opportunity to engage consumers / patients in a way that's currently not being done, which I think is going to be really, really interesting to see how that unfolds.
Well, those are very fascinating kinds of data and uses of data. And I'll put a third big group in there, which I'll put in the cut and dried kind of data category, and that's the data that comes from insurance claims. And, you know, I have to make a confession that it's only a few years ago that I realized there was something known as the All Claims Database. And as I've come to learn about and see how some the states that have adopted that use that as a very powerful tool to look at healthcare costs and population health. In the states, you get a sense that by marrying the clinical data that now emerges from the electronic health records and some of the more consumer-directed modalities that you described with the claims picture might offer us a really new way and an enhanced way of looking at healthcare costs. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about how we can marry claims data and clinical data to really get that 360-degree assessment and a much better handle on managing costs.
Sure, of course. Well, I think, you know, for starters, when you look at the most kind of successful health systems that are out there, the large IDNs, integrated delivery networks, you know, groups like Kaiser Permanente, Intermountain Healthcare out of Salt Lake City in Utah, and, you know, Geisinger in Pennsylvania, these organizations have not only the provider side, but they also have the insurance side too as well. And when you look at how progressive they are and how they're able to you know, collaborate on other sides, in particular now that we're moving from something, you know, we're moving from volume to value in terms of how organizations and physicians are going to be reimbursed in the future. It's going to be extraordinarily important to have, like you said, that 360-degree view. So, for example, when you're looking at how that data can be actionable, it can be significantly more beneficial when you're looking at, you know, cost, but also outcomes, and how you're looking at that clinical side and then also the business side of it. So organizations are doing a lot in and around that. You know, again, I think it's an area that's still early on, and most organizations have not gotten that sophisticated at it at this point in time, but it's something that, you know, we're going to see more and more of in the future, particularly when you look at, you know, accountable care organizations and how they're required to collaborate with one another and the amount of risk that's required for them to take on. It's going to be something, again, that these organizations have to embrace and marry up that information.
Mm-hmm. I know we have at our community health center, we're about 8 years into an electronic health record, but I know one of the things that we have to do is we draw all that data down, put it into data cubes, and mine it ourselves. And I want to get back to your report, which was the analytics, the nervous system of IT-enabled healthcare. Part of the reason we do that is there's so many holes in the current electronic health record system, and for other practices, obviously, who are on paper, there's almost it's not conceivable that they could mine that data. So we've got a lot of folks out there, big players. You mentioned ONC, the Office of the National Coordinator, the Civic Commons, and others, trying to close the loophole around this and generate a system for a unified platform. So on one hand, tell us how those folks are doing and the progress they're making. And you mentioned a couple of folks who are getting it right. Maybe drill down if you've got any examples of smaller scale institutions. I think everybody knows the sort of common ones that are thrown around. Anybody that you're excited about at a smaller scale that might be more accessible to smaller practices that might be listening to us?
So, quite frankly, this is one of the biggest issues preventing us from realizing the full value of electronic health records and having patient health information in an electronic format. Now, you know, the federal government has, for the most part, said that, you know, listen, the private sector needs to solve this rather than mandating specific standards that here's what we're going to use and here's how we're going to exchange data. And that provides opportunity in the private sector, but it's also created, I think, frustration. Now, some interesting things that are happening on that front is just back in March, the Commonwealth Alliance was actually announced, and that's a consortium of some of the largest vendors, for example, Allscripts, Cerner, McKesson, and a number of others that have come together and said, listen, we're going to work together and put together a way where within their own platform, they can exchange that information, that data. Epic is another technology vendor. If you are a Epic customer on Care Everywhere, and if I'm a patient and I go to another health system that also has Epic Care Everywhere, the idea is that those systems can talk and engage one another. And I think this is an interesting trend that we're seeing now. When you look at the footprint that these electronic health record vendors have across the country, you know, there are the HIE groups that are out there that actually help exchange that information and data. That's what they're in the business of, exchanging that information. And I think it's a rather profound and important trend, and particularly when you look at the amount of money that have been expended on health information exchanges, you know, at a local level in different regions across the country, and how so many of them have not proven to be sustainable. The big point for me to drive home is the fact that this is an area that still needs tremendous work, and until we can solve this challenge, we're still going to struggle to leverage electronic health records and health information technology in the way that it was meant to.
We've been speaking today with Waco Hoover, co-founder and CEO of the Institute for Health Technology Transformation, one of the nation's leading organizations committed to bringing public and private sector leaders together to foster the growth and effective use of technology in the healthcare industry. You can find their full report and more about their work by going to www.ihealthtran.com. Waco, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, this week we'll take a look at the individual mandate that's part of the Affordable Care Act. It kicks in January. At that point, Americans, with a few exceptions, will be required to have health insurance or they'll be assessed a penalty. There are exemptions from that requirement, primarily for low-income persons. Those who earn too little to be required to file tax returns are exempt. That would be those earning up to $9,500 a year or $19,000 a year for a married couple in 2011. The threshold for 2014 will be a bit higher. Also exempt are employees who are asked to pay more than 8% of their household income for work-based coverage and persons who have suffered a hardship in obtaining insurance as determined by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Finally, the law exempts members of Indian tribes, certain religious groups that are exempt from Social Security taxes, and those with only brief gaps in insurance coverage. As for everyone else, if you don't have health insurance, you'll pay a penalty. It's $95 for the year in 2014, but it goes up to $695 once it's fully phased in 2016. And then from there, it increases with inflation each year. And those with higher incomes will pay 2.5% of income that exceeds the threshold for filing a tax return. How many will pay this penalty? Well, the Congressional Budget Office estimates have indicated that about 6 million Americans will pay the penalty, yielding $6 billion for the government. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.